It's just 2 years since 9/11. Actually, it makes it easy to remember that today is my first granddaughter's first birthday. So, but I think of 2 years ago in this class, I had just heard, just before I left for work, the news, and came in, and about two-thirds or three-quarters of the class had not heard anything about 9/11. And I started describing it, and found out afterwards that maybe a third or half of the students in the class thought I was doing another thought experiment. And when I realized, there was a sense of unreality, because I was giving some details on what I had just heard on the news. And it was so unreal that Greg, and as a TA, and quite a few of the students thought that I was, this was a more imaginative thought experiment. What a sobering day that was and has been for all of us. I don't think there are many events in a lifetime that we remember quite as clearly as that. I remember Kennedy's assassination, and I can remember the headline in the paper when the first atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and a few events like that, but very, very few that impress themselves as dramatically on our consciousness as 9/11. And I think in part because it does perhaps, or did remind us that this is an incredibly unsafe world in many, many respects. The technology and international strife and different ideologies and so on, it did in a certain sense usher in a new age. And but I just wanted to say a word about it, and also to at least say for myself that it was utterly remarkable to me, not unexpected, but still remarkable, the incredible heroism of the firefighters and others who went into these buildings and knew that they probably had a very good chance of never returning. It's to me that represented a strain of American life that is pretty important, and we often don't think about it. I think sometimes as academics we tend to downplay patriotism and heroism, but that was heroism at its best. These were people who really made an incredible sacrifice to try to save others. No one, of course, knew that the buildings would collapse as they did, although even when they went into the buildings, it looked awfully bad. But I just wanted to mention that. In that sense, it's a very sobering day. We have been talking about the meaning of nature, and I think we've already seen that it's an incredibly tricky term. And in almost every culture, nature, man, God, these are probably the three most difficult terms, and they're very closely interrelated, difficult philosophically or metaphysically or theologically. Because it's in terms of these terms that we situate ourselves and that we understand who we are. As I've already suggested, and will develop more fully as the semester goes on, my understanding of ethics is that a very large part of ethics is answering the question, who am I? What's the world like? What's happening? What is nature? What are animals? And so on. And that once you get reasonably clear in your own mind about the answers to those questions, much of what you ought to do or ought not to do morally, policy-wise, and so on, is fairly obvious. So it's because of that that I spend a fair amount of time looking at these basic terms. As I was preparing some of this and thinking about it, I came across these quotes a number of years ago, but then recalled them. A couple of quotes from Carl Sagan, who, as you know, was a professor here for many years at Cornell. In his well-known book, Cosmos, which was also a TV series, he says, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." And that's right at the very beginning of the book, the opening sentence. And the last sentence of the book, "Our obligation to survive and flourish is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring." Those two sentences are very, very interesting to me as a philosopher and theologian. And in a way, they're fairly jarring. In the first sentence, for instance, when Carl Sagan says that the cosmos is all it is or ever was or ever will be, it's very clear that he's not speaking as a scientist. He's speaking as a philosopher or theologian. And in effect, he's saying, I think that basically he's an atheist. If you say the cosmos or nature is all it is or ever was or ever will be, that sounds as if there's not much room for God or the supernatural. And that statement is not made, of course, as a scientist, because there's no way you could test it. There's no way you could have evidence for it or against it within the realm of ordinary scientific method. But then I find even more interesting, in a way, the last sentence of the book, "Our obligation to survive and flourish is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring." That I find odd, because a number of places in the book, he's told us very clearly that the cosmos doesn't give a damn about you and me. The cosmos is utterly indifferent to who we are. We are the result of countless misprints in DNA, mutations that were then exploited by natural selection. We are accidents, so to speak, within the realm of Carl Sagan's philosophy. And thus, it seems at least a bit odd to me, in fact, quite odd, that the cosmos doesn't give a damn about us, but we all have great moral obligations to it. Now, I believe we have moral obligations vis-a-vis nature, clearly, but I wouldn't argue them in that way. And part of what we are going to attempt to do in the course is to look at different ways in which you can ground moral obligation vis-a-vis the care of nature. Those two quotes just struck me as extremely interesting. In a way, they're even more interesting if you take two quotes that have played a very important role in Western culture and religion. Verses from Genesis: "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters." A very different worldview, and one that in many ways is in conflict with the former. And much of environmental ethics has to do with how we view the world in which we live and how we have viewed ourselves. And the second verse from Genesis: "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth.'" That also, these also are very interesting verses, and they've had an interesting history in the whole recent environmental awareness, particularly stemming from roughly 1970 and Earth Day. Indeed, many environmentalists, and we'll look at this also in detail later, have argued that biblical thinking, Judaism and Christianity, have been one of the main culprits in the whole abuse of the environment, because they've spoken so clearly about having dominion over nature and subduing nature. And we'll look at that in some detail. Just to give you a little preview, I'm going to argue that human dominion over nature is not, first of all, a moral issue. It is, first of all, just an empirical observation. It seems to me that if there's anything at all clear about our relation to nature, it's that humans, whether they want it or not, have a kind of dominion over nature. As soon as the forebrain expands to the size that it is, humans are very different from other creatures that we know. We begin to control fire, refine metals, develop weapons, and then the almost asymptotic increase in technology and science of the last 50 or 100 years or more, we have enormous power over nature, whether we want it or not. And I think in some ways, many of us are very afraid of it. We almost long for the old days when it wasn't possible for us to destroy ourselves and nature too. So first of all, I'll argue later in the course that dominion over nature is not, in the first instance, a moral issue. It's an empirical observation. To be human is to have power over nature, including human nature. And that, as I indicated in the very first lecture, is perhaps one of the scariest things of all, that we have now the power, it looks like, to destroy ourselves, to abolish ourselves, perhaps, by altering the genome so drastically that we would no longer be recognizably human. And we're going to look in detail at what is implicated in this dominion that humans have. To me, the issue, morally, the interesting issue is not whether we have dominion over nature. That's just obvious that we do. The moral issue is how you use it. Do you use it responsibly? Do you see yourself as a trustee, a steward, having fiduciary responsibility for nature? Or do you just continue to exploit and beat up on nature because we have the ability to do so? But let's look a little more carefully at the terms nature and natural. They're extraordinarily complex terms. The Oxford English Dictionary lists 18 distinct meanings for natural and 15 distinct meanings for nature. They're extremely important terms in philosophy, theology, art, not to mention the use of the term by ecologists and environmentalists. The first point I want to make clearly is that the question, what is nature, would be far easier to answer if it were not for the further questions. Who is this person who asks the question, what is nature? How does this person who asks, what is nature, himself fit into or relate to the concept of nature? The question, what is nature, is so complex, I think, because of who we are. Who are we asking the question, and how do we relate to nature? It doesn't seem as if animals ask the philosophical question, what is nature? It's conceivable they do, but we certainly have no clear evidence, and most animals don't seem to have the neural development, the parts of the brain and so on that humans utilize when asking that kind of question. We can't be sure, but it seems that they don't ask that sort of question. How do we fit in to the equation? In the first place, if we see humans as basically somatic beings, as physical beings, understood according to the laws of physics and chemistry and biology, I don't think we have too much difficulty thinking of humans as fully comprehended under the category nature. If all we are as humans is blood chemistry and the laws of physics and ordinary causality that we see in the various sciences, then it would seem that the answer is fairly simple. It would be an answer somewhat close to that of Carl Sagan's, that the cosmos is all that is, and blood chemistry and ordinary biology and so on is all that we are as human beings. Obviously, we are part of nature, and we are fully part of nature. We can understand ourselves, perhaps, in purely reductionist terms, as the kind of methodology, for instance, typically used in physics or chemistry. Although even here, there are some biologists, and not just theists, but also biologists who are atheists, who are beginning to wonder whether ordinary reductionism in science is going to be adequate to understand the complexities of the brain. Michael Polanyi, a chemist who went into the philosophy of science, and others are beginning to think that we may need to develop a new logic, a new way of thinking about living organisms that goes beyond simple reductionism. And those are tough questions. The whole functioning of living organisms we're discovering is extraordinarily complex. Secondly, if we understand humans as possessing freedom to choose among various future possibilities, then the question, who are we, becomes a good deal more difficult. Now, it's always possible to explain human freedom, our experience of freedom, as basically an illusion. It's possible to believe, as some do. My good friend Will Provine, he and I have debated this issue on various occasions. Will Provine has argued and believes that we are basically robots, that there is no free will, that everything that we do is fully determined by our blood chemistry and the laws of physics and so on. Freedom, for Will Provine, is simply an illusion. I respect his position. I think he's wrong, but he argues the position well. And indeed, there is an awfully lot of evidence that we probably are a good deal less free than we think. My guess is that we are far more determined by genetics, by environment, by Madison Avenue, by early enculturation and socialization than... Did I bump your coffee?
No, it was my fault.
Oh, okay. I just had this sudden panicky feeling that I bumped it and knocked it over there. Okay. I think we're probably far less free than we think. And many philosophers and others have believed that an awfully lot of what we do is genetically determined, and, as I suggested, determined by early socialization and so on. Just ask parents who will have three or four kids and raise them all roughly the same, and one or two of them will just be incredibly different in some cases from the others. So in that sense, I think it's meaningful to discuss the whole question of freedom. And I suspect also that much of what we call freedom today is almost the opposite of freedom. We'll look at this later in some detail. People who sort of live just according to the whim of the moment probably are among the least free of all people because they're prisoners of their momentary desires. The extreme case of this is addiction to drugs or alcohol or sex or whatever. People who are addicted seem to be free on one level, but on another level are not very free at all. And I think, if we're honest, most of us have to admit that we, to a disturbing extent, are prisoners to television and Madison Avenue and politically correct thinking and all the rest. St. Augustine argued coherently, I think. He argued that perfect freedom is perfect obedience. The person who is fully free is the person, Augustine thought, who lives fully in accord with the will of God. To be a slave of God is to be perfectly free. Now, that may sound odd, until we begin to translate it a little bit, you may think you're free to disbelieve in and disobey the law of gravity, but if you go up to the top of Bradfield and decide to jump off the 11th story, your freedom will be short-lived. You may think you're free to ignore sexually transmitted diseases and all kinds of other things, but your freedom may not be as fundamental as you think. So Augustine is probably onto something when he argues that freedom, basically, and Plato believed much the same thing, freedom is living in harmony with reality. Freedom is the kind of life that comes when you align your life not with your own preferences and choices and desires, but with what is good and beautiful and true, according, say, to Plato. Question?
It just seems to me that logic, that saying by default that God is true, that there is a God.
Sure. If you align your life according to the will of God, you would have to believe that that's true. If you align your life according to the good, the beautiful, and the true, if you're a Neoplatonist also. But let me give you another example. This is almost exactly what many modern environmentalists are saying. They're saying, live in harmony with nature, obey the laws in the sense of ecology, and don't just beat up on nature, treat nature well, live kindly towards nature, align your life to these ecological realities rather than just fighting them, and your life will be good. But on the other hand, if you insist on just beating the hell out of everything in the environment and just living according to your whim, your life will not be good. So that's a very interesting parallel. My point here is not to convince you to believe in God, it's to think about and we'll deal with this, the whole lecture on this later, what is the meaning of freedom? Because in our culture today, we think of freedom as being able to do whatever you want. Freedom is a lack of constraints. We have very little understanding of John Adams, I think it was John Adams, saying, when he referred to those wise constraints that make men free. If you live in accord with the moral law, if you live in accord with environmental reality, with the balance of nature and everything, you will be much freer than if you just insist on doing whatever you want. So it's a very, very interesting question. I don't want to develop it further here because we're going to come back to this rather more carefully somewhat later. Now, a variation of this second point of man, of humans as possessing freedom, would be humans as responsible moral agents. And here, as the philosopher Immanuel Kant argued, we're really in trouble if we think of humans as fully a part of nature, at least if we accept the model of nature even remotely resembling that of the physicist or chemist, and perhaps today the biologist or even the ecologist, we're in trouble because the moral life probably is not conceivable if we don't have some kind of freedom. If you're just a robot, and this is one of the ongoing discussions that Will Provine and I revisit from time to time, if you're just a robot, then what does moral responsibility mean? You don't exhort your automobile or your computer, except partly in jest or for fun. You don't blame them. I mean, we do, but we know that it doesn't make much difference. I sometimes, when my car makes it up Klein Road on a snowy day, I pat it on the dashboard and compliment it, but it's, we're aware of what we're doing. Because we know that they don't have the freedom to do any different, do anything different from what they're doing. And so if we're just robots, if we're just blood chemistry, if everything can be reduced to atoms in motion and blood chemistry and so on, then it's very difficult to think of humans as having any moral responsibility, just as it is, incidentally, I mentioned this, I think, in one of the earlier classes, if all moral judgments are subjective and relative, just personal opinions, then I really suggest you all drop the course, because why would one want to spend a whole semester just sharing our prejudices with each other, our personal tastes and opinions? We normally don't do that with things that we recognize as purely subjective, if anything indeed is purely subjective. That's another question. Now, fourthly, perhaps the most fascinating single item to think about in connection with the relation of man to nature is that peculiar capability human beings have to think about their own thinking and their own acting. As the philosopher Hegel points out, and I should add a big footnote here, I'm drawing very heavily throughout this lecture on a piece by Gordon Kaufman, a Harvard theologian, who wrote a piece back in 1972, A Problem for Theology, The Concept of Nature. Much of what follows in the next 20 minutes will be drawn directly from this fine piece by Gordon Kaufman. Kaufman asks us to think about the fact that, as Hegel pointed out, and I'm quoting Kaufman here, the self, the human self, is that peculiar kind of being, unlike any other of which we have experience, that is reflexive upon itself in such a way that it can become object to itself. That is, you're not only able to think or to perceive objects, think about or perceive objects in the external world, but you can also think about the fact that you are thinking about objects in the external world, and this regression could go on indefinitely. That's why some introspection turns out in the end to be fairly fruitless. Now, again, there's a distinction here, I think, between the whole question of an infinite regression philosophically and mathematically, but I don't want here to take the time to go into that. The point I want to make is that we possess that very strange ability to step outside of ourselves and ask the question, how am I doing? How should I live? What's the right thing to do in this situation? And we don't have any good evidence that other animals do this. It's possible that mountain gorillas and a few species begin to approach it. But it's certainly not anything like what happens in human beings. Well, with that background, let me return to the basic issue. I'm not going to review all the 18 meanings for natural and 15 meanings for nature that the Oxford English Dictionary gives, but let me point to two of these in particular, because I think these help us understand how the term functions philosophically and in environmental discussions. And the first of these is the rather straightforward meaning we give to the term nature when we think of wilderness, when we think of the nature of the romantic poets and artists, the nature that we so often have exploited through our reckless use of science and technology. This is the nature of the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society and so on. Now, obviously, this is already somewhat of a range of meanings, but they're roughly in the same camp. Nature here is understood, and again I'm drawing from Kaufman, as distinct from the artificial activities of human beings who modify it and use it for raw material in the creation of culture. There's a tension between culture and nature. We speak of the natural and the artificial, of the natural and civilization, wilderness and civilization, and so on. It's in relation to this nature that many people experience feelings of awe and mystery, even ecstasy. This is a feeling, these are feelings that in some ways are basically religious or very comparable to traditional religious feelings, a sense of exaltation and mystery and wonder. And indeed, we have in various cultures and among various people the worship of nature. It's meaningful to speak of the worship of nature when we're thinking of the nature of Thoreau at Walden Pond or John Muir in the High Sierras and so on. This is the nature that was so wonderfully photographed by Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter and others, and the various schools of art and painting. This is the nature we have in mind when we talk of saving the redwoods or the Amazon rainforest. It's this nature we're thinking of when we speak of what is natural as over against what is artificial, or as was so popular in the 19th century and early 20th century, when we refer to the, quote, noble savage, or the primitive tribesmen of some distant continent, or the glories of some long past golden age when human beings were, quote, in closer touch with nature. This is the nature, in other words, that we contrast with culture or civilization. It's also, interestingly, a nature that has a darker side to it. This is also the nature of the ancient Canaanites who sacrificed their eldest sons to the nature god Moloch. Interestingly, it's also, in some odd respects, the nature of Adolf Hitler in the Nazi Party. Hitler was one of the really great conservationists of the early 20th century. He had a kind of almost religious attachment to Blut, Boden, Volk, the blood, the Aryan blood, the earth, the people with a capital P, in almost a religious sense that all of this was tied in with a kind of pagan nature worship that was very powerful. And as we can see, there was a darker side to it. It resulted in incredible evil. Now, obviously, I've run together a fair range of meanings, but I think not irresponsibly so. There's some commonality here. Civilization, culture on the one side, nature, wilderness on the other. The artificial is over against the natural. The city is over against the wilderness. And when we speak of nature in this way and argue that humans should stop polluting or ravaging or exploiting nature, then at least in some sense, we see ourselves and our activities as over against nature. At the very least, I think you will have to admit that when we use nature in the sense I just outlined, that is, nature as over against culture or civilization, it is difficult, if not impossible, to argue that humans are fully a part of nature, and that we can comprehend ourselves fully within the category nature. And this is particularly the case if we define ourselves as possessing freedom and the possibility of responsible moral reactions to situations. Rather, in some sense, human beings seem to be acting upon nature. We appear to stand apart from or outside of nature. Now, let me stop here and look at a fundamentally different understanding of the term nature. According to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, and again I'm quoting Kaufman, the concept world, Welt, W-E-L-T in German, the concept world serves as an ordering principle or a regulative idea by means of which we bring all the individual and particular objects and events of experience into relationship with each other and into a unified whole. World or cosmos or universe is never an object of perception or experience. It can never come into view or be in any way directly experienced. It is rather the backdrop against which, or context within which, we have all our experiences and within which we know ourselves to be situated. you never can observe the cosmos or the world because these are intellectual constructs that humans have created to make it possible to make sense out of who we are and the experiences we have. You can't observe the cosmos or the universe in principle because some of the light waves and galaxies are going in totally different directions. Much of it is already past. Some of it is the first 300,000 years or so after the Big Bang seem to be almost totally inaccessible to us, although we're narrowing that gap somewhat. So cosmos is not an empirical reality at all. It's an intellectual construct. And that's another reason why Carl Sagan's comment is so interesting, is because I think he's using the term in a somewhat inappropriate way. Let me quote Kaufman at this point. These are difficult quotes, but they're very, very interesting. He says, if we treat the concept of world or cosmos as fundamentally like other concepts which refer to or represent objects identifiable in experience, we get into insoluble antinomies. An antinomy refers to a contradiction between two statements, both of which seem to be compellingly true and obtained by correct reasoning. And this is not only because, as Kant held, of the impossibility of conceiving clearly, not to say experiencing, spatial and temporal absolute limits. It is also because the world includes within itself all space and time as its abstract structure, and thus all events occur within the world. But it is obvious that not all events are occurring simultaneously. Some have occurred and are over with, some are yet to come. The world, then, which includes them all within itself, never, quote, exists as world. Only certain features of the world exist at any one time. Thus, it is not merely that we never do, in fact, perceive or experience the world as an object. In principle, that would be impossible, for world or cosmos is a concept for which no object in that sense exists at any one time at all. The notion of world is a construct created by the human imagination as a heuristic device, that is, a device that helps us learn or discover, as a heuristic device to make possible the ordering and relating of all our other concepts or objects and events. It is thus indispensable to our thinking and even to the orderliness of our experience. And in every culture, we find some sort of, often mythological, notions of this widest context within which human life transpires, but it is itself not an object of experience. It is a fundamental presupposition of experience. Now, this is where the problem arises. There is what I would call a certain semantic slippage in our use of the term nature. Very often, we use the term nature in the first sense I identified. Redwood trees, saving the rainforest, and so on. But we also use the term nature as a synonym for all that is, as a synonym for world or cosmos. And interestingly, in many cases, we use it in both senses in the same paragraph and don't always recognize the contradiction, because these are two quite distinct meanings for the term nature. So if you define nature as all that is, in the sense that Carl Sagan does, of course we are fully comprehensible within the category nature. But if you are thinking of the meaning of nature as wilderness or redwood trees over against the city, then you have a very different situation. And it's because of this ambiguity and this semantic slippage that we often become incoherent, I believe, when we discuss some of these issues. Nature, in many respects, functions like the concept of world, but it also functions in the first sense of wilderness over against the city. As Kaufman points out, It can stand for the totality of all events and objects, that is the term nature can, the whole within which all fall and of which they are a part. But in this second sense, that is when nature is used in a way similar to the term world, then nature is no more perceivable than is world. It is a construct of the mind. There is no empirical reality nature when you mean by nature all that is. That's an intellectual construct that enables us to think clearly, comparable to the term cosmos or universe. And the reason we frequently get into trouble with our term nature more often than with the term universe or cosmos is precisely that nature is concrete in a way that world is not. Let me quote Kaufman again at this point. Kaufman says, whereas world refers simply to the totality, the whole, and thus to nothing directly experienceable, nature refers in addition to particular dimensions or qualities within the whole, to structures and events which can be perceived and experienced. We would typically not say that a tree is worldly, but there are no problems at all in regarding it as natural. Whereas to speak of the laws of the world, that is, of the cosmos, sounds exceedingly abstract and obscure. By laws of nature, we designate everyday experienceable regularities in, for example, light and sound and gravitation and so on. Now, the fact that the term nature can be used comfortably in these very concrete examples in a way in which the term world cannot derives, I'm arguing, from the ambiguity in the term itself. As Kaufman points out, nature refers not only to the totality, but also in contrast with culture or the artificial, to certain features or qualities within the world, namely to that which exists and functions independently of human contrivance or interference, that which is other than the human, over against the human, sharply distinct from culture. Kaufman concludes this part of his discussion with the very perceptive remark. He says, thus, although nature, like the world, is the overall context within which all that we are and experience have their being, it has an immediacy and experiential concreteness for us which world does not and cannot have. Nature is experienceable as well as conceivable. World is only a concept. It is for this reason, Kaufman concludes, perhaps that nature can be regarded as the source and ground of all being and life, Mother Nature, in a way hardly imaginable for the world. And so nature can come to have a kind of religious meaning and become the object of religious devotion and a direct rival to God in a way that typically is not possible for terms like world or universe, although in Carl Sagan's writing, the term cosmos sometimes begins to function more like the term nature. So all of this leaves us, I think, with a real dilemma. The concept of nature, which Thoreau and Muir and others work with, the popular nature of the wilderness and the Sierra Club, can inspire awe in us. There is a sense of mystery. It has a kind of immediacy which makes it possible to think in terms of nature worship, for instance. But this concept of nature does not make it possible to speak very meaningfully of human freedom and moral responsibility, nor to speak of the peculiar nature of human beings themselves as self-reflexive, that is, the ability of the thinking subject to reflect back on itself, treating itself as an object. On the other hand, when the term nature is used like the term world, then it is basically a mental construct, not an empirical reality. And here it doesn't make much sense to think in terms of worship. That is, unless one wants to worship a construct of his own mind. Now, the atheist would think that God is also a construct of the human mind, and there's the argument, or that's where the issue is joined. You might want to worship the universe or the cosmos or the world in this sense that Kaufman talks about, but if you do so, you may be worshiping a construct of your own mind, and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to most of us. Furthermore, such an analytical construct simply doesn't evoke a worshipful response from people in the way that nature in the other sense may do. When used like world, the term nature may be broad enough to include all aspects of reality, including man's freedom, sense of moral responsibility, and self-reflexive capabilities, but insofar as the term is a construct of the human mind, either one would have to admit that the human mind is the ultimate reality, which I guess most of us probably don't want to do, or else one would have to posit some kind of cosmic mind or self, which puts the idea in man's mind, again, a tack which some of you may not want to take. Also, it doesn't make much sense to think of worshiping this kind of nature, that is, attributing to it some kind of ultimate value, that is, unless one wants to worship a construct of the human mind. Okay, that, I think, brings us partway, at least, to understanding why we often get into trouble with these terms. They are very, very much more complex than we often think. Any comments? Just we have a few minutes. I'd hope to have a little more time for comments, but any comments or questions here? Yes.
I think the terms are only complex because people like these philosophers keep analyzing it over and over and over again until we find that complex.
That's a possible view, but I guess I would argue that it's probably no more likely than arguing that contemporary physics is complicated because physicists like to fool around. I think if you could show why this is not the case, I would be open to that. But I think the basic argument that I've been making is fairly straightforward, namely that the term nature itself is just extremely complex. And I've just given two basic meanings. I think they're the two most important ones for this course. So I think we do sometimes complexify things when we don't need to. And one of the hallmarks of good scientific thinking is simplicity and elegance. But I think in this case, the complexity is probably warranted. But we can talk more about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in response to that, I mean, any word is as complicated as we use it. And we use nature so that it's the nature of language, per se, for it to reflect how we use it.
Mm-hmm.
If we use nature as, like, as the same way as we use the word chalkboard, then obviously it would be complicated and would hold the same meaning of a specific object.
Okay,
so I think it's explaining all these concepts, and they're just analyzing how we use it.
Okay, that's a better answer to the first comment than I gave. What I think you're saying, and I think this is a better answer, is it's not that the philosophers are manufacturing complexity, they're simply accurately describing how people actually use the terms. I think that's probably a better answer than I gave you. Yeah. There was a hint, yes. I think this will probably be near. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was a column in Bloomberg, I believe, after the blackout a couple of weeks ago, that's touching on the idea of freedom, of actually having freedom, that basically argued that while we believe ourselves to have power over the world, basically that the more power we exert over the world in building societies and in building power stations and modern technology, the less power we have, because when the electricity goes out, we're at the mercy of what we built for a while.
Very, very scary. I think we all see this. The more our automobiles, I used to know enough about automobiles that I could fix most things or get a friend to do it, but today I feel helpless, and I think you're exactly right that is a different side to this issue. Okay, thank you.